Bishop.
Very well, welcome, very good.
I would like to ask a question of you.
Oh.
Where is that wonderful monitor where you can see your hair?
Yeah,
up there?
Could you zoom in closer? Closer, let's see the hair, get in closer on the hair.
You know, the reason I ask is that I'm a pretty old acquaintance of Senator Jackson. And I was sitting in the green room, listening to the show and watching. And you led him twice into saying, let me make one thing clear. And would you believe this hair was black when I arrived at the show?
Yes, I noticed that echoing, indicating the pervasive influence of the president.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, at least twice you said that.
Twice.
Yes, significant for students of history. This book is significant for students of history, he said, making a neat link. But one of the things that fascinates everybody most, I think, about we want to talk about the life of Martin Luther King, but about the death of Martin Luther King. Can you summarize for us your findings about James Earl Ray? Your feeling that James Earl Ray was hired?
I am positive that he was hired because the history of his life of crime shows that he was not only an ignorant man, but an abysmally stupid one. He could not learn how to commit a crime. And he spent, I think, two-thirds of his life, the first 37 years, either in prison or trying to figure a way of getting out of it. And he got himself caught in air ducts where human beings couldn't fit. And they had to cut him loose the following day, half starved. He held up a grocery store one morning, and he needed a partner. And he picked a criminal who was old, retired and deaf, and gave him a gun and said, you stand in the back of the store, I'll leave the engine running on the car, and you just hold the customers at bay, don't let them move. And then he, with his gun, asked the lady clerk, where is the manager? And she said, down in the back, he's packing the cans of soup. And James Earl Ray went all the way down the back and found this man crouching, you know, putting cans of material on shelves. And he said, this is a stick-up. And the man looked up very calmly and said, oh, you want some money? And he said, yes, I want some money. I want a whole lot of money right now. And the man said, well, now, just a moment. And then he finished packing the cans. And he went up a different aisle from James Earl Ray. So the James Earl Ray, as he went up the aisle, was aiming at cans of merchandise. The manager was on the far side. And when they got to the end, they met again. It was a very gentlemanly sort of thing. And he aimed the gun at him, and he went upstairs and got $900 in cash. Became so nervous, he dropped 700 of it and didn't pick it up. And just kept waving the gun and back toward the door, got his partner, and said, let's go! You know? And the other man hopped in the car. James Earl Ray got on the driver's side, and he pressed the accelerator to make a U-turn and forgot to close his door. And his body swung outward on a U-turn, and he was hanging onto the wheel. And so that it was like an old Keystone comedy, and he went tearing up this cobblestone hill at 80 miles an hour trying to get back in, get in the car. And when he got to the top, he went over the side, and a policeman arrived at the grocery store and said, gonna stick up here? He said, yes, just went over the hill. Okay. He went up the hill at 80 miles an hour just as James Earl Ray, outwitting the police, made a U-turn and come back and passed them going the other way. And they finally caught him in the woods, and he just said, oh, I'm too tired. I give up. I'm the sort of thing. I just can't make it. So he was always in jail and always trying to figure a way out of jail.
Really,
he couldn't learn anything. Now, when you consider that this man, provably, now I'm not talking about Jim Bishop's opinions, I mean provably was broke 6 months before the assassination of Dr. King, provably enrolled in bartender's school or school of bartending in Los Angeles, lived well out there in a second-rate hotel, had $13 in Alabama, in Birmingham, a week before the assassination, bought a white Mustang for $2,100 in cash 2 days later. Went to the Aero Marine Supply Company at the airport in Birmingham to buy a gun for the assassination. And when asked by the clerk, what kind of a gun do you want? He said, I think it's a deer rifle. And the clerk said, well, what do you want it for? He said, well, my brother and I are going deer hunting. He said, oh, then obviously you need a deer rifle. We gave him the rifle, wrapped it up, and it was $137 with ammunition. Within 1 hour after he left the store, he was calling back saying, I picked up the wrong rifle. What I want is a Remington 424 repeater with a scope on the top. So there you see, someone was counseling and advising and paying. Someone was giving him airplane tickets to Great Britain and to Rhodesia, with whom we had no treaty. You see, we couldn't bring them back. And my computations make it about, it cost about $20,000 to keep this man going to the assassination. But you see, if you are going to arrange an assassination of this sort, and let us say you are a wealthy person in Birmingham, and I sort of feel that it was in Birmingham, and you and your confreres chip in the money, what you do is you don't hire James Earl Ray, the stupid oaf who's going to commit the crime. You hire a middleman who hires the assassin. Therefore, there is no trail leading backward. Now, it's reasonable to assume that Mr. Ray might get out of jail right now if he could only find his middleman, the man he calls Raoul. He said, that's the only name I knew him by. But he must hunt among 203 million faces to find Raoul. And then from Raoul, perhaps we could find out who originated the assassination of Ray.
Why do you have a feeling, a hint of suspicion about Birmingham?
Because almost every time that James Earl Ray wanted money, went broke out on the coast or in New Orleans, those were two favorite stops of his, he went back to Birmingham and suddenly he had the rent money, he had food money, and he had a car.
Does that mean that Raoul was in Birmingham or the people who hired Raoul, do you think?
Well, I think the people who hired Raoul were in Birmingham. There's nothing, as I say, there's nothing on which you can base this except too many coincidences. See, it's like unbraiding the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. If 50 things had not occurred in correct sequence, he could not have been shot that night.
But wouldn't you, if you came from Birmingham, make sure that the contact, Raoul, was positively not in Birmingham? Doesn't that point to the fact that it wasn't Birmingham?
No, I don't think so. I think that they felt very sure of themselves, and I think they had a good middleman. And I think that the fact that they told him to go to the Aero Marine Supply Company, somebody told him because he didn't know the place. And ironically, you know, it was at the Birmingham airport, and the Reverend Martin Luther King at that time, 5:04 p.m., was flying back from Memphis to Atlanta and crossed the airport. That's on a direct flight route. So that he and his assassin were 25,000 feet apart on that day, at that hour.
We're going to take a break there, the music in the background. We'll come back with more of the investigations of Jim Bishop.
Progresso presents a short course in Italian soup. Progresso makes six authentic Italian soups that are thicker, richer, and more delicious than ordinary watered-down soups. And we make sure they're authentic by using our own ingredients, like our famous minestrone, overflowing with vegetables, pasta, cheeses, and just enough seasoning. If it's Italian, and if it tastes good, it's Progresso.
Most banks just sit there waiting for people to come to them. But Maryland National is the bank that comes to you. For instance, you want to arrange a new car loan. Just pick up the phone and ask them to send you a do-it-yourself car loan kit. Fill it out at home. And when your loan is approved, you get back in the mail a thing called a car check. Well, then you go pick out the car you want with the money in your hand. You never even have to go near the bank. Isn't that nice? Maryland National brings the bank to you.
Now it's your turn. Take the taste test. Instant natural house coffee against the leading freeze dry. Bet you're going to be on my side.
What's the point of launching a serious discussion about prisons with some fictionalized Hollywood hokum? Well, hokum or not, very few of us know much about prisons other than what Cagney, Raft, and Bogart taught us. Perhaps our worst crime is our ignorance about crime, our smug assumption that it is all a matter of some tough bad guys whom the tough good guys will soon capture. The words, the book, the title we have borrowed are Dr. Carl Menninger's.
If a correctional officer today, if he isn't a humanitarian, he cannot be a correctional officer.
You can give a resident, a person in the street, all the programs you want. If he's not ready to be rehabilitated, you can't do anything about this.
Judges send people to institutions that they don't know anything about for reasons that are totally absurd.
You keep him down if he's on drugs. You keep him down if he's a homosexual.
Talk back to the news, The Crime of Punishment, an open debate of our penal system, Sunday night at 10:30 on Channel 5.
Welcome back. I was just talking to Jim Bishop about, we were just talking there in the break about how much American history Jim's been present at, and in fact, fascinating P.S., postscript on what we were saying earlier to Senator Jacks. You said you were there the very morning that he was telling about.
Yes.
The morning when the call came through.
What he told you about on this program, I was there with him that day. Well, what happened was that the day before,
this
I had been with
the JFK.
Right. I had been with John F. Kennedy in his car, and we drove with a chauffeur, and he sat in the front seat, and he kept tapping the leather, you know, on the dashboard, and he said, "I'm going to make it in two ballots or not at all." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because all my delegates are pledged to two ballots, and if I don't win it in two, they will fly like birds." And I said, "I wouldn't feel that way. You may make it on the third or the fourth." He said, "No, two or nothing." And I said, "How about the vice presidency?" He said, "Well, that's another plateau. That's another world." He said, "Of course, Jackson and I get along well together. And geographically, it's good. I'm from Massachusetts. He's from the far west." He said, "It's my kind of a man." And I took all the notes that I could, you know, as he was talking. Then went and watched the, you know, nomination. And then knowing what I did know, that Jackson was the big man, I went right to Jackson's headquarters the following morning. And I said, "Have you been appraised of the fact that he's thinking seriously of picking you?" He said, "Yes. Where did you hear?" I said, "I heard it from John F. Kennedy himself." And he said, "Come on in the room with me and sit down, because I feel very nervous and I've been watching that phone." And there was a sort of an off-white mantelpiece with a white phone on it, and this huge barrel of Washington apples. And these senators, you know, bring their products wherever they go, even if they happen to be armadillos, which is the only thing she hasn't got on the farm. And I don't know why it was, but I got nervous. He seemed calm, and I began to eat these apples. And, you know, you eat a ring around them and leave the two ends sort of fat, and then drop it, and I'm looking at the telephone. And after a while, there was nothing but silence, except for my chewing on apples. And I think I was about a tenth of the way through that barrel when the phone rang, and I almost bit the core in half. And he picked up the phone and he said, "Hello? Yes, Jack. Yes? Oh, sure, I understand. Absolutely. Oh, yes. Well, you count on me, Jack." And he hung up and he said, "I don't get it." I said, "You don't get it? Who gets it?" He said, "Lyndon Johnson." And that's how far Henry Jackson was from the presidency of the United States. Less than a barrel of apples.
A barrel of apples and
wine. Yeah, a barrel.
That's a fantastic story. Yeah. And then did he, what was his next reaction?
He didn't seem too depressed to me.
Not unprintable at that particular moment.
Oh, no. No, no. No, no. He seemed to understand the sense of what Sam Rayburn was trying to do. And Sam Rayburn was more than Speaker of the House. He was a little doorknob head with a real whim of iron. And he said, "The Kennedys are going to need the South." And he said, "We take our Lyndon Johnson, we put him right on a ticket with him, and then you insure the South."
I hear the music. We've got to take a break. That's another postscript. We'll be right back.
I put down this GAF joystick floor all by myself.
She couldn't have done it without me.
I picked out this Bright Futures pattern, and I laid it perfectly just by feeling it and pressing it down.
She couldn't have done it without me.
I put down this GAF joystick floor all by myself.
She couldn't have done it if I didn't move the furniture for her.
Get somebody to move the furniture, and you've got it made.
Where do you want this piano, lady?
Introducing Fabuliner, Revlon's automatic liquid eyeliner with built-in brush. It draws a perfect line.
I'm all thumbs.
Fabuliner draws a perfect line every time.
It won't skip?
It draws a perfect line.
It won't run.
It draws a perfect line every time.
It does draw a perfect line.
New Fabuliner by Revlon draws a perfect line.
Every time.
Clark Gable stars as a gambler with Lana Turner as the aristocrat he marries in Honky Tonk on the Sunday movie, Sunday at 1 p.m. on Channel 5.
Sad news. Two marvelous storytellers sitting here, and we're at the end of the show. The 90 minutes are up. And we have to say goodbye there and invite you to join us tomorrow, and we'll have an hour of Engelbert Humperdinck. Until then, bye-bye for now.
Promotion fee paid by National Airlines. National Airlines flies 747s between New York and Miami, and between Miami and Los Angeles.
And his other great hits. But right now, let's welcome someone who was with us just for a while, just recently, with his comedy, and it was so great. We found we've been going for 45. He was in great storytelling form. We only have time to start talking about his new book, The Days of Martin Luther King Jr. We're talking about a lot of his other stories as well, and so we wanted him to come rushing back as soon as he possibly could. Will you welcome back? This is the day we talk to Jim Bishop again. Jim Bishop.
How are you?
Welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome home, indeed. We talked last time you were here, Jim, about your findings, your fascinating findings on the death of Martin Luther King and on James Earl Ray and so on. Mm-hmm. What do you think was the most, as you did all this incredible research, you said you did more research on this book than any you've written.
Right.
What to you was the most dramatic moment you discovered, the most dramatic confrontation in his life? In the life of Martin Luther King?
I think the worst, the most dramatic was when he was autographing his first book in Harlem. And a group of ladies were waiting in line with copies of the book. And a middle-aged woman ran up to him and said, "Are you Martin Luther King Jr.?" And he said, "Yes." Shook a letter open and stabbed him through the chest. And it touched the aorta of the heart. And when I got him to the hospital, the problem was not so much how to remove it, but how to keep him from a cough or a sneeze, which would expand the aorta and touch the blade, and he would die instantly. So for 3 hours, there was a problem there of holding him quiet and giving him sedation so that he wouldn't feel a cough or a sneeze coming on. And then, after the x-rays were taken, watching which side of the blade touched the aorta of the heart, and then to try to bend it in the opposite direction to free it, and then slowly withdraw it. And he was, I think, magnificent throughout this thing. I'd have been terrified. I think almost anyone would. But he understood his own personal danger and how close he was to death, but remained very quiet and orderly throughout 3 hours.
One of
the lady was found to be insane and was taken to court and was sent away. She had no idea why she wanted to do this thing. She had no idea of her own identity or what she had against him.
It's one of the most terrifying forms. I mean, thank God in that particular case it was an assassination, but I mean, there's something almost more terrifying about a great man being pointlessly killed, even than being killed as a result of a plot, isn't there? It somehow seems...
Well, don't you imagine that a man like Martin Luther King thought of assassination all the time? Don't you think that John F. Kennedy thought of this?
Yes, I remember.
He sat with me, I know, 3 weeks before he went to Dallas. And I would not have introduced that topic as conversation, but I sat in his Oval Office with my wife, and he said, you know, I read a book of yours called The Day Lincoln Was Shot, and I said, indeed. He said, I liked it very much. And I thought, I'd better drop this. And he said, you know, I feel it about assassinations the way Lincoln did. They can't overprotect you, and if anyone wants to trade his life for mine, I think he can take it. And I didn't know how to respond to that, because it's true. It's a proper assessment. But then, so that he wouldn't have to live with this feeling of assassination. Most presidents, after they've been in office about 90 days, tend to let the thought float away from them. It floats out of their mind. They become immersed in the business of running the administration and the nation. And in Kennedy's case, he decided to transmute the fear into a joke. So he would go to church on Sunday, and he would have two Secret Service men in front of him and two behind him. And then, as they genuflected, as they, five of them came out together, they would turn with their backs to the altar and walk toward the rear of the church. And the president told me that he used to flex his knees until he got smaller and smaller and smaller. And in this comic position, very small, he would whisper to the two men in front of him, if there's anybody up in that choir loft trying to get me, they're going to have to get you first. That was his little joke.
Are there assassination attempts made on presidents and so on? And I mean, genuine assassination attempts that we never hear anything about? I mean, that are foiled and that are not announced because they put ideas in?
No, if there are threatening letters or threatening phone calls, the Secret Service has a very good computer file on almost every city in the United States. And people who have had psychiatric treatment or who have been addicted to crimes of violence or even threats of violence are listed. And they can pretty much get anybody they please.
And you mean if a president is going into a certain city, they really like the Dallas, but yeah. I mean, in the case
they
of...
They have a word for it, they call it sanitizing. They go in and sanitize the place.
Which means...
Well, when Eisenhower went to church, the National Presbyterian Church, they used to sanitize it so well the night before that the minister couldn't come back into the pulpit and get his notes, the sermon tomorrow.
But the minister was allowed into the church to give the sermon.
He was allowed in the church at the proper time after the president was seated. And I have been to church with two presidents, Lyndon Johnson and Dwight D. Eisenhower, and it would be very difficult for me to assess which was the worst thing of the two. They were very bad and very loud.
Very close in the...
Well, Mrs. Eisenhower was so shocked by her husband's voice that while she had her hymn book open, and she's tiny, you know, she used to look up at him like that and frown at him. But it meant nothing to him. He sang straight ahead, right to the height of the church. And he never hit the right key even by accident.
He obviously had the same blithe assurance I have. The only place I ever sing is in church, because I think no one else can hear at all. I suppose God can hear, and he must have a very good ear, but I mean, it just doesn't worry me something.
Well, you've been brought up to believe that God will forgive anything.
You've got so many words. I gather in preparing your book on... your next book on FDR, you've unearthed some facts about Winston Churchill, was it?
Well, one I think is a little bit fascinating. I am addicted to the anecdote which epitomizes the man. You see, anything which does that. For example, in the case of Winston Churchill, early in the war, the president invited him over for a secret visit, and Roosevelt took him down to Pompano Beach, Florida. And Edward R. Stettinius, who was then Secretary of State, had a beautiful big home there. So the Secret Service, as usual, sanitized the whole area. No one was allowed on the beach, and for a mile around, there was a cordon. And One of the Secret Service men, Mr. Howard Anderson, the very impeccable gentleman, and a man who I don't think would say a cross word at any time, a man who thinks and phrases sentences mentally before he utters. And he drew the Dawn Patrol, and he was standing on the beach, and the Atlantic in that area is rather jade in color, and the waves are small. And the first green and pink rays were coming up over the edge of the world. And as he watched it, he saw this chubby figure come down the main staircase to the beach, with a big cigar in his mouth, and a bathrobe, and bare feet paddled toward the ocean. When it came to the ocean, one foot was lifted and a big toe was stuck into the water and withdrawn. And then this figure uncinched the cord of the bathrobe and threw it off. There was the Prime Minister of Great Britain, nude. And Mr. Anderson, who is retired now and who lives in Virginia, said, all I could think of was a Cupid doll. A round head and a big belly, and he said, one of those Cupid dolls that you can turn the head around, and he said, cigar and all, the Prime Minister tiptoed into the Atlantic Ocean, and when he got up to the waist in his nudity, he turned around to look at the building that Satinius owned, and as he was studying it, a slightly larger wave slapped him in the rear, caught him unawares, and dumped him right on his cigar in the sand. And Anderson stiffened because he knew that the Prime Minister was a rather formidable man, a man who would fight Nazis, who would fight anyone, and who was aggressive. And he wondered what would happen to the Atlantic Ocean as a result of knocking the Prime Minister over.
We'll be right back with Jim Bishop and Barbara Walters.
Jim Bishop, who was just telling me in the break, there's more to that. Tell me.
Well, Mr. Anderson, as I said, was wondering what horrifying thing would happen to the Atlantic Ocean as a result of dumping the Prime Minister. Mr. Churchill came out of the water with his busted cigar and dropped it on the sand, turned around to the Atlantic Ocean and glared at it and went like that.
I'd have thought he'd have given it the famous V sign, but he chose...
Oh, no.
No, he didn't. He chose that. That's fascinating. Hey, there was one question I was going to ask you, because one of the interesting things in your book on Martin Luther King is where you talk about the guiding light or the steering light in his life being Coretta King and so on.
Yes.
And in all the things you've observed between famous men and their ladies and so on, I'd love to talk to you about that. But I think we ought to welcome a famous lady to join us before we get into all that. She's just about to... be beamed to us in a few days from now from Iran, and she's off to Japan as well on another one of her world exploits. Her book, How to Talk with Practically Anybody About Practically Anything, is now in paperback. Bargain price of $125. Will you welcome back Miss Barbara Walters? Lovely to have you with us. Jim? Come and sit down, Barbara.
Thank you.
Great outfit.
I can never dress like this in the morning, and I wasn't sure I had nerve to dress like this in the evening.
Well, on behalf of everyone, we're delighted that you did.
Thank
Welcome
you.
Back. You're just off. You're reading up about Persia and...
I don't know what I'm reading about at this point. We're going to Japan. The whole Today program is going to Japan. And then the Today show comes back, and I go on to Iran. It's kind of difficult.
As an intellectual coward, a man who could do it, who had all the means and the gifts, but who didn't do it. And of course, in the later years, well, for instance, he was afraid of being physically hurt, he was afraid of being hit, he was afraid of going to jail, yet he would stand up in the Baptist church and ask everyone to hold up their hands and pledge, let's go to jail, even if it's forever, after the demonstration tomorrow. And then he would be bailed out of Birmingham jail in 3 days. 700 other blacks.
That's Mr. Bishop.
I know.
Well, you don't know. I find it amazing, having read about his life and heard him talk. At one point, they did a year or so ago, I guess it was last year, a 2.5 hour film, which perhaps you saw, when King had chosen walking through the streets of the suburbs of Chicago, we didn't expect to get into all of this tonight, so I'm hardly prepared with all of my facts, but he talks with great humor. That was the time that he was the most terrified of any time, he said, of all of the attempts that might have been made in his life and all of the ways in which he exposed himself. And there was the scene in a helicopter in which he talks of it with strength and with humor. And when you see the people who are following in his footsteps today, like Reverend Andrew Young, I think there is such courage that I really am just amazed.
I think Andrew Young and also the Reverend Jesse Jackson surpassed him.
But I mean,
I think they passed him by. They were disciples who took over from him. And also, I rather suspect that you don't know that he made a deal with Leroy Collins not to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge at Selma so that he wouldn't be shot at.
But surely when you go...
I don't know that, and I find it very hard to believe.
Uh-huh. Well, it's documented.
Yeah, but even when you go through all of your dad's or what moments when he was afraid or whatever, I thought you end up, don't you, with a record of his life of a man with a far beyond the average amount of courage, and surely far beyond, I mean, put to tests. Well, the story you told just now about retaining his nerve when the knife was next to his heart and so on. And I would have thought that, I mean, there are two forms of courage, really, aren't there? There's the, I always feel there ought to be two decorations in war, except you could never work out who deserves which. In the sense, there's the form of courage of someone who's a dunderhead and doesn't realize that they're going over the top of that hill and they're going to get shot. Mm-hmm. And that is courage of one sort, but it's an unknown courage. The courage of the intelligent person who realizes the odds are 10 to 1 against his living, but still goes over, though terrified, that's real courage. And surely that...
Well, I think you will find...
I think you will find that in reading the book, that Martin Luther King was really the intellectual leader of the movement. That he, when Rosa Parks' feet hurt and she sat in front of the bus in Montgomery and sparked this thing, that Martin Luther King was the leader, and without his assistance, I don't think we'd have had the great forward progress that we've made. He sparked it. He started it. But I must remind you that, for instance, in Memphis, the first time around the garbage man strike, he was lifted bodily out of the line. And Bernard Lee, who was his bodyguard, told me, he said, we had to hail a strange car with two ladies driving it and say, can you get him back to the hotel quickly? Because he was terrified at the fire, the 11 rows behind him and the smashing of windows and the demonstrations and the wild cries and the surging police and the billy clubs and the electric prods and things of that sort. And so that he is the father of it, but I think there's a vast difference between being the intellectual leader and being the actual leader in the streets.
I think he was more than the intellectual leader. I thought he was an inspiration to his people.
And he did march in the streets, and when the marches that were the marches that took place, the big march on the bridge was a march that he led, and he marched, you know, as I said, I know we were going to talk about this, and I would have come more prepared, but there were days in which the man marched, and he was in jail, and his family was persecuted in the way, as bad as it is now, it was certainly not that way then. I think it's a new approach, and I think it's an interesting
march,
approach.
The first march in Selma, he missed entirely.
Well, whether
and
the man marched every march or didn't,
no,
or entire
no, wait a minute.
Feet or whatever.
No, you can't have it two ways. You've got to have it one way or the other. Either he did or he didn't. And in the first march, he said his leaders persuaded him not to lead the march across the bridge. And then that was a Sunday. And then Tuesday, he was back to lead the march, and that's when he made the deal with Leroy Collins. And Colonel Al Lingo of the Alabama State Troopers said, well, if he marches across the bridge and doesn't go beyond those barricades, there will be no firing.
You know, you said earlier, you were talking about Lincoln, and it's been said, but I can only say it about Martin Luther King in this case, and you do have much more information than I, but when you read about his life, and when you meet his family, and when you see the people who are devoted to him, and what he did for the country, and see the kind of physical activity that he did involve himself in, you can fool some of the people some of the time, etc. And Martin Luther King, I don't believe, could have been an intellectual coward and fooled as many people who love him and believe in him, and I'm a latecomer, and have that affirmation.
We'll be right back.
Talking about family life of various kinds earlier and about women behind famous men and so on, but I gather it's fascinating. We're right in the middle of a fascinating time in your family life. Your daughter's
it's her first day of school this week. She's three. That's a day in the life I'm going to record
What preparations have you made? Gigantic preparations?
Well, you know, of course, if you live in a big city, you don't know, of course, because you certainly don't know, of course, being a bachelor. But you get audition now for nursery school. And you, in New York City especially, you go to nursery school after nursery school and you bring this little tot with you and they look you over and it's like applying for college. So we went all through this last year. And the joy, you know, when you open the thing up and she's accepted, and the grimness, I mean, she was accepted last year at three schools and she was turned down by one. I hate them. And also you wonder, how can they know that much about, at that time, a 2.5-year-old, you know, and all the nervousness. You don't know whether to dress her up, you don't want to look as if she's, you know, like you care too much. On the other hand, you don't want to, you know, bring her into a little play clothes because, you know, oh, it's really so, have any of you gone through it? It's so foolish.
And,
but,
and you were questioned about her, were you?
Yes, you're asked questions about yourself and your life and what she's like, what she plays, you know, what are her favorite toys. She's very big on blocks, you know, and she loves Play-Doh. Is that good or bad?
Yeah. And you try to guess whether it's going down well.
This week we go, just before I leave, I'm so pleased that I can take her. We both go, Lee and I, Daddy and Mommy, we both go for the first day of school. She's fine, we're scared to death, you know. She'll drink her juice and eat her cookies and we'll cry. You know, I can see she's going to leave us and she'll say, don't be nervous, Mommy and Daddy. Now, don't cry. You know, I'll be all right.
Do you stay for long? No, you just...
The first day?
Yes.
Do you really care about this?
I'm fascinated, yeah.
Everybody asks me, you know, about people I interview and tell me what so-and-so is really like, and I sit here discussing my child's first day. You have a break-in period for the parents to break us in. You go for an hour, and then you go for 2 hours, and then you stay. Are you asking me for any reason? I mean, are you contemplating anything?
No.
What was that?
No, but can you remember your first day at school?
But you see, when I was very young, which was in... I bet you know so many things about everybody, I bet you know. But we didn't start then. He does know, doesn't he? No. I may agree with you about almost anything if you promise not to tell us. We started at kindergarten here, which is at 5. Well, now they start at 3. Really, if you live in a big city, because I was just an only child, and we would like her to have little friends to play with, so she's...
Were you terrified your first day at school?
I was very unhappy in school all of my life until I went to college. Because my father was in show business and we traveled so much, I went to 3 different high schools in my 4 years of high school. And I was a very good student. I was a grind. I worked very hard because it was a way of kind of, you know, establishing yourself and so on. And what I hope most now for her is that she enjoys it, is that education is pleasurable and exciting for her. It shouldn't be, you shouldn't have that kind of butterflies the first day of school, the pain. And I think too many children have it.
Lucky because I went to an ordinary school out when I was about 6 or 7, but before that we happened to be in Bedford in England, and I went to one of these Froebel Montessori free discipline schools where they don't tell the children off at all, which I think is insane. And there was a kid in our class, luckily at the age of 6 or 7 I went to school where kids, that you just got belted, and that was much healthier. But I remember that there was the big hero with kids on the radio, the big serial on the radio, the Batman equivalent, was Dick Barton, Special Agent, it was called. And what would happen was the teacher would be saying, and then you subtract 7/11 from 12/43 or whatever it is. And I remember a kid standing up in the front row, turning around to the rest of the cast and saying, as loud as this, Dick Barton, Special Agent!
And the teacher said, which comes to 5 and 1100. I mean, it's insane, you know, because the child knows best.
But now, we do also have everything on television. You know, mine goes to school now at 3 from Sesame Street. She can count up to 20. She's not that brilliant at... Well, she is that brilliant at child. She does the whole alphabet. And from watching television shows, my husband was home the other day with his son, who's big fellow, 26, and Jacqueline walked in, threw herself in a pillow on the floor and said, can I take a walk with you guys? Now, where do you hear? Obviously, she'd been watching the David Frost show.
Something. All of today's show. We're at the end of the show. We'd love to say thank you, Barbara. That was delicious. Jim, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to Hank Snow. And thank you to George Fallon. Bye-bye for now.
Marshall Bay was provided by RCA Victor Records for the appearance of Hank Snow.
Promotional fee paid by National Airlines. National Airlines flies 747 between New York and Miami and between Miami and Los Angeles. Automobiles provided and promotional fee paid by Chevrolet, makers of Nova Coupe. Not too big, not too small, and not too complicated. Nova by Chevrolet, building a better way to see the USA. Office space provided with the Royal Manhattan Hotel. When visiting New York, why not stay at the Royal Manhattan? In the heart of the Midtown Theater District. Enjoy convenience and comfort at the Royal Manhattan.
Okay.